Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Eleanor Smeal, president of the Feminist Majority Foundation, who assesses the current attempt to make healthcare reform a vehicle for eroding women's access to legal abortion. Tiffany Seibert, with the group Voices for Children in Nebraska, who explains why a diverse group of activists have come together in her state to restore funding for prenatal care for undocumented immigrant women. And a 2002 interview with one of the nation's most passionate campaign finance reform activists, Doris Granny D. Haddock, who died March 9th at the age of 100. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The push for a new United Nations agency for women remains stalled amidst diplomatic wrangling, reports the Interpress service. The new agency, first proposed by a high-ranking panel of United Nations experts in 2006, has become known in diplomatic code as the Gender Entity. Resistance to the new agency has emerged from developing countries who belong to the G77 bloc and the non-aligned movement. And Russia and Japan have asked for clarifications. A new women's agency was the brainchild of the civic society campaign known as European Gender Equity Architecture Reform, or GEAR. Daniela Roche, a gender rights campaigner with Oxfam Novib, stated, "Why do women's rights and gender empowerment issues take so long to tackle? Where is the sense of urgency in this regard?" UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has endorsed the new women's agency, but has frustrated feminist activists by not naming a new Undersecretary General to run it. However, Norway's Minister of Children, Equity and Social Inclusion says the new gender agency should be operational by September, when world leaders gather to assess the progress of the Millennium Development Goals to combat global poverty. In León, Nicaragua, a 27-year-old woman named Amalia is being denied treatment for cancer because she is 10 weeks pregnant and chemotherapy may damage her fetus. She is a victim of Nicaragua's harsh abortion ban passed in 2006. Amalia's family has gone public with her story to local newspapers in an effort to obtain treatment. The new law, negotiated between President Daniel Ortega and the Catholic Church, was driven by conservative outrage when a 9-year-old girl sought an abortion after being raped by a relative. The American Prospect magazine reports other developing nations have followed Nicaragua's lead in seeking a complete ban on abortion. Last spring, the Dominican Republic amended its national constitution to ban abortion. In largely poor East Africa, unsafe abortions are common, making up 20% of all maternal deaths. In Kenya, conservatives are praising a proposed total ban on abortion, claiming the ban is needed to help counter the growing influence of foreign-based feminist and family planning groups. U.S.-based anti-abortion groups are heavily involved in drafting Kenya's ban on abortion. Overall, there is little evidence that indicates harsh anti-abortion laws have slowed demand for terminating pregnancies. In early March, Utah Governor Gary Herbert signed a new law that allows the government to charge a woman or teenager with murder if found to have intentionally caused her own miscarriage. Women's and civil liberties groups in Utah have criticized the new law, sponsored by conservative state legislator Carl Wimmer. Marina Lowe, legislative counsel with the ACLU of Utah, told Alternet, "We are passing legislation that seeks to criminalize women for their actions." The law grew out of an incident last spring when a 17-year-old girl, who was 7 months pregnant, paid a man to beat her up to cause a miscarriage. Melissa Byrd, head of the Planned Parenthood chapter in Utah, opposed the miscarriage law, stating, "What happens to women who are in abusive relationships? What happens if a woman threatens to leave her abuser, falls down the stairs, and loses her baby?" Byrd concluded, "What we are doing is driving women underground and preventing them from getting health care and prenatal care." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
what some pro-choice activists describe as an effort to enact the most sweeping legislative abortion restrictions in 30 years may well be the last major hurdle supporters of a compromise health care reform bill will need to overcome in order to win passage. Although the Hyde Amendment adopted by Congress in 1976 prohibits any federal funds to be spent on abortion services for poor women, Representative Bart Stupak, Democrat of Michigan, wanted to go further. With both Democrats and Republican allies, Stupak succeeded in amending the House health care reform bill to extend the abortion ban to cover subsidized insurance policies which women buy with their own money. However, the Senate refused to adopt Stupak's anti-abortion language in their version of health care reform legislation, but nevertheless included provisions that make it nearly impossible for women to access abortion coverage. Now, with President Obama and Democratic congressional leaders pushing to pass a final health care reform bill before Easter, Representative Stupak and possibly 11 other Democrats have pledged to vote against the legislation unless it includes the more restrictive anti-abortion language found in the House bill. With Democrats planning to first pass the Senate bill and then quickly amend that legislation to terms agreeable to both chambers via the budget reconciliation process that cannot consider abortion issues, it's likely that Representative Stupak will not prevail. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Eleanor Smeal, a lifelong activist for women's equality and former president of the National Organization for Women, who currently serves as president of the Feminist Majority Fund. Smeal assesses the attempt to make health care reform a vehicle for eroding women's access to legal abortion and what this debate says about the strength of the pro-choice movement.
We now know that the National Conference of Catholic Bishops kept on insisting on more and more, that the reality is this bill does not fund abortion in any way. In fact, it cuts back the rights of women, and then he wanted it to cut it back, he or the bishops, wanted to cut it back even further by saying a woman couldn't even pay for it with her own money. The whole thing is so outrageous. And they say they care about people and that he really wants health care reform. And the bishops want to help the poor. But in reality, they've stood in the way. And they've used this as a hammer, even though it never did cover abortion. And now the Senate bill even cuts it back more by putting in a requirement that you have to segregate the money even of the person. A person has to pay for it in two payments any abortion coverage. The whole thing is preposterous, and we just have to get more pro-choice votes in Congress, and I think we have to say no to the really violations of separation of church and state that the bishops have been pulling.
You and others have made the case that the Catholic Bishops' Conference here in the United States played a very important role in lining up Representative Stupak and others to use the health care reform legislation as a vehicle to further restrict abortion rights for women.
That's right. I mean, it was pretty blatant. They didn't hide it. They were definitely in the back rooms pushing. And in fact, they got... And all their fighting on the House side. In other words, they fought the House side to put the Stupak Amendment in. And then they pushed on the Senate side. And even though the Senate bill clearly did not fund abortion, they pushed more and they got some provisions in for adoption because basically they have contracts on adoption. They are constantly pushing for things that benefit them. And I think that more people should know that. I mean, you know, this whole business of separation of church and state, I don't think the American public is aware of how much taxpayer dollars go to things like Catholic charities. They do all the time. So basically, they pushed like there was no tomorrow and demanded. But then they did one more thing, and I've had several members of Congress tell me this, that they threatened excommunication if you voted against them, and they threatened that they were going to score it. I just can't get over it. But the excommunication, I just think it goes one step too far. I mean, this is ridiculous because obviously a religious principle is also taking care of the poor. And a lot of this measure takes care of the poor. And these representatives are elected to represent their districts, to represent people of all faiths and those who are non-believers. I mean, this is not to be religious representatives in Congress.
Eleanor Smeal, what does the current debate about health care and the inclusion of abortion say about the strength of women's equality and the pro-choice forces, as well as the strength of the anti-abortion movement?
Well, I personally feel that abortion is being used as an issue to stop women's rights and also to stop progress. The business interests use it. And I really feel that this bill, the reason why the health care reform has had so much trouble, is maybe this issue, but I think primarily it's the insurance interests. And I believe the reason the Republicans have been voting as a bloc is those insurance interests. So they'll use the religious issues to hide behind, but this is a bogus issue. Because basically, it doesn't, you know, there is no federal funding to abortion in this bill, period. It's in black and white, right in the writing. And what worries me is that instead of discussing the issue, some opponents of bills now make everything that pertains in the least to women an abortion bill. So we don't have to really discuss whatever the merit of the bill is. We now will just discuss this issue. So it's being used, unfortunately. And I think that political people and a lot of people have had it. They can't be whipped around. Every issue can't be made an abortion issue on one side. On the other side, women's advocates must get a pro-choice Congress. This is just awful. So some people say they're for us. They run on tickets saying they're for full women's rights, and then they vote against us. And that happened here. We lost people who said they were pro-choice. This bill could have been so much stronger. We have to do something about the business interests, and I do feel very strong. When I say business interests, I should say it more specifically. The large corporations, these big multi insurance companies, that, you know, some areas there is no competition at all. There's just one insurance company or two for a whole state. We have to see through the scare tactics that are being used to defeat real progress for people. And, you know, it's a shame. We're one of the richest countries in the world, and we're the only one without full insurance coverage. And so many lies and so many distortions. They get away with it because too many people are not active. So I'm hoping people that are listening to this, if you become upset over this debate, first, let your representatives know, and senators, that you want this finished. You want health care reform. Not perfect, but at least it's a step. And that, two, that you vow that you will get active so this can't continue.
That was Eleanor Smeal, former president of the National Organization for Women, who currently serves as the president of the Feminist Majority Fund. Contact the fund at area code 703-522-2214 or visit their website at feminist.org. Nebraska is the latest battleground for those fighting to provide prenatal care for undocumented immigrant women. The issue has united those on all sides of the fetal and maternal rights debate. A bill now being considered in Nebraska's unicameral legislature would permit undocumented women to receive prenatal care, thus joining 14 other states and the District of Columbia. For 20 years, Nebraska actually had been a leader in offering immigrant mothers this service under Medicaid without any problem. It was only when the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services discovered the scope of Nebraska's prenatal services in November that the agency decided to cut off funding. Federal officials required more than 6,000 women receiving prenatal care to be reevaluated for coverage based on their own eligibility and not on the welfare of their unborn babies. Nebraska's conservative Republican Governor Dave Heineman has pledged to veto the bill, LB 1110, that would resume government-funded prenatal services for low-income, undocumented immigrant women. As of March 1st, 842 undocumented pregnant women lost their access to prenatal care, while 709 expectant mothers holding U.S. citizenship also lost their prenatal coverage. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Tiffany Seibert, policy coordinator for the group Voices for Children in Nebraska. She explains the history of the legislative effort to restore prenatal services to all women and what's at stake for both mothers and children.
We spoke with one woman who, upon review, made 48 cents too much to be continued eligible. And so she was kicked off the program and lost access to Medicaid. There were 415 citizen women who failed to provide information, whether that would be about their citizenship status or income. Some women were being sanctioned either for not meeting Employment First or our public assistance requirements, work requirements. And there were a variety of other reasons. But one thing that we think is important to keep highlighting is this clearly did not just affect undocumented women, although that's certainly dominated the conversation, but 709 citizen women also lost access to prenatal care as a result of this policy change.
So what are the efforts to fix this and provide this care? And if you could talk about the range of the groups involved.
Well, Voices for Children is one of many groups working to pass a bill which would restore our priority to provide prenatal care to all babies born in Nebraska. We have been working with a variety of organizations. There's advocacy organizations, medical groups, religious and faith groups, public health associations, the pro-life organizations in the state, a couple of them, as well as the Nebraska Catholic Bishops Conference we've all been working very closely to remind legislators that this is about babies being born healthy in our state, and reminding our legislators that these babies once born will be U.S. citizens. They will be part of Nebraska's future, and why wouldn't we want that future to be as bright as possible?
Tiffany Seibert, people are talking about costs either way, but there's an economic argument that can be made for providing the care and spending the money in order to avoid much higher costs from complications resulting from lack of prenatal care, right?
Absolutely. We know that the costs, not only human costs to babies who are born not as healthy as they can be, but there are significant economic costs. By many accounts, the cost of prenatal care is really an investment in prevention, and often an entire course of prenatal care can be cheaper than one day spent in the neonatal intensive care unit. Babies, when they are born too small or too soon to survive without significant medical intervention, they can spend days, weeks, months in the neonatal intensive care unit, racking up just, you know, millions in some instances of medical costs. And so there is a significant economic argument to be made that to the extent that prenatal care and a simple investment in prenatal care can prevent some pretty substantial economic expenses, what we try to remind folks is that when these babies are born in Nebraska, they are U.S. citizens, and they have available to them all of the opportunities that U.S. citizens do. One of those opportunities in the state of Nebraska for low-income kids is access to Kids Connection, which is our public health insurance program. So once these babies are born, they are eligible for public health insurance. And so we can pay now or pay later when these babies are born not as healthy as they could be.
I've always thought that pro-choice and anti-abortion groups could get together in promoting access to birth control because that would obviate the need for many abortions. But I've found that's not true, that in almost every case, someone who's against abortion is also opposed to birth control. Do you feel like this collaboration among people with very different points of view on abortion might result in cooperation on issues going forward?
Well, you know, I would say that the collaboration has been really great. We are so pleased to find that such a large number of groups and powerful groups in the state have found common ground on ensuring that babies are born as healthy as possible and recognizing that a small investment in the health of the child before they're born can really create the best opportunities for that child as they go on. So I hope that we can continue to work with this great and broad coalition on a number of issues about investing in the health of our children and providing them the best opportunities that they can to have a healthy childhood and grow into productive and healthy Nebraskans.
That was Tiffany Seibert, policy coordinator of the group Voices for Children in Nebraska. Contact the group by calling area code 402-597-3100 or visit their website at babiesbornhealthy.com. Doris Haddock, known as Granny D, died March 9th at the age of 100. She is best known for her year-long cross-country walk a decade ago, undertaken at the age of 90 to promote campaign finance reform. Haddock was politically active most of her life. After finishing her trek, she continued working on this cause, speaking all over the country as states debated passing their own campaign finance laws. She took time off from that work in 2004 to run as the Democratic candidate in her native New Hampshire against Republican Senator Judd Gregg, garnering 35% of the vote. She used her candidacy to speak out against Bush administration policies, including the war in Iraq. 3 days before her 100th birthday, the Supreme Court released its decision allowing corporations to invest directly in political campaigns, and she issued the following statement. Quote, "The Supreme Court, representing a radical fringe that does not share the despair of the grand majority of Americans, has today made things considerably worse by undoing the modest reforms I walked for and went to jail for and that tens of thousands of other Americans fought very hard to see enacted. The Supreme Court now opens the floodgates to usher in a new tsunami of corporate money into politics." End quote. Between the lines, Melinda Tuhus had the joy of meeting Granny D at the Grassroots Radio Conference in the summer of 2002, where she conducted the following interview.
I was a little old lady, 89, living in a little village of 1,400, member of the planning board, a deacon in the church, voted, paid my taxes, so I thought that I was a good citizen. But when I called Common Cause, the office that had put this notice in the paper and asked what in the world is going on, they said, "Well, don't you understand about the corruption that we have in this country today?" And I said, "What corruption?" I said, "Isn't this an unusual thing?" They said, "No, not really, but it was caught, so don't worry about it." I said, "Well, I am going to worry about it." They told me the buzzword was campaign finance reform, so I began cutting clippings out of various papers and making a scrapbook. And in a year's time, I had two great big scrapbooks just full of campaign finance reform that I had always ignored as much as other people do because it didn't mean anything to me.
So you walked across the country, you met people all over, you spoke at many rallies. I read your book. It seems like you created quite a stir. You skied into near Washington at the end when it snowed and you couldn't walk. You've certainly been an inspiration. That was over 2 years ago when you finished in February of 2000. You finished your walk across the country. So how do you think your walk had an effect, if any, on the campaign finance reform bill that we finally got this past year, the McCain-Feingold bill?
Well, I think I helped it get passed. I mean, I was told that I had put a face. This is what McCain said. She had put a face on the bill. She made people aware of what was going on. And when it came time, people rallied and kept that phone ringing at the end so that people would know that in the Senate and the House that they wanted that bill to pass.
Do you think that the campaign finance reform bill, the McCain-Feingold bill, and the companion Shazmian bill in the House, now that they're signed into law, that it will make a difference? Do you think it's strong enough to make a difference?
I don't think it's a very strong bill. I think that in order to pass it, they changed the amount of money, hard money, that they doubled. Before it was you could give $1,000, now it's $2,000, and that was an awful slap in the face. But if they were going to pass it, you know, politics is compromise. But I think that was too big a compromise, but it seemed like that was the best they could do. And now, the FEC, do you know what the FEC is? The FEC is a federal election commission, and they get the bill after it has been signed by the president, and they're supposed to clarify the language so that anybody reading it would understand what it means. But that isn't what they're doing. They're tearing it apart. And so when they get through with it, it's not going to be even as good a bill as it was if they're allowed to get away with what they're doing.
So what are you doing? I understand you've been doing some campaign finance reform work, walking in some individual states in favor of changes in the state laws?
Yes. Now, we have four states that have public funding, and we have two states that have used it in one election and think that it's wonderful. It's better than sliced bread, both in Maine and in Arizona. But in Massachusetts is having difficulty getting it into play, and Vermont is going to have it this next election. My feeling is that there's been a great many good things that we have in this country that started in the states. There are 50 states working on this, working for public funding. And if you get a critical mass, if enough states are able to get started, then it will spread to federal. I think that's the only answer. The people that are in the House and in the Senate today have been elected under the present system, and they know no other.
Just kind of summarize what you learned from that experience, walking across country, meeting people all along the way, talking about campaign finance reform.
It is never too late to get in shape. It is never too late to go and look for a new adventure. If you have a dream, there's no reason why you can't go ahead and fulfill that dream.
That was an interview conducted in 2002 with Doris Granny D. Haddock, who died March 9th at the age of 100. Melinda Tuhus produced an award-winning documentary about Granny D's 2004 Senate candidacy and her philosophy of life. Granny D's courage, passion, and friendship will be missed by many. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced in association with WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.